The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands and millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this 7-day session here at Turtleback Zendo in northern New Jersey. And I'm going to share with you a series of emails that I received from a student in California. This is a woman who has phenomenal karma, actually, you know, breathtaking, more than breathtaking karma. Her family carries some genetic baggage that results in a high incidence of allergies, severe allergies, ones that you have to carry an EpiPen for, and which periodically send her into shock. She's the one in her family that has the most intense version of this cascade of genes, and was all set. She was actually in culinary school and following her dream to become a pastry chef when the first anaphylaxis occurred, and gradually it became obvious that she was allergic to a roving host of triggers, and she never knew what would trigger an anaphylactic reaction. You know, most of us, when we have reactions to things, we get itchy or we develop hives or something like that. To go into anaphylaxis is a little bit more rare, although it does happen. And in fact, it happened to me quite a long time ago on an airplane, of all places. But for her, it happens unbelievably frequently. She carries 6 EpiPens, and they're so expensive that it's actually cheaper for her to go to hit herself with the first EpiPen and get herself to an ER than to go through the whole series of 6 EpiPens. She's young. She's 30. It's been going on since she was about 18. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. She went through a period of time where she was having a series of anaphylactic reactions that were actually shutting her heart down. And at one point they were having a devil of a time getting it started back up again and maintaining. But they eventually were successful. She is in the hospital more than she's out of the hospital. It's kind of hard to hold a job under those circumstances. And she's fortunate in a sense. She's a social worker, and the whatever division of the state of California that has hired her is allowing her to come when she can, and is continuing to pay her, not full time, because she's not able to be there full time, and so she has some level of coverage, but it's not sufficient to really take care of her. She has to live at home. There's mental illness in the family, doesn't help, and so she's in an extremely stressful environment with extremely stressful issues in her own body. The allergies have been getting worse and worse and worse. They actually gave her chemo that successfully knocked out certain of the cells that were triggering allergies, but she's got more than one of these conditions where she reacts violently to anything and everything. And as I said, it's a changing round of characters in terms of what will trigger anaphylaxis for her. More recently, she's had to be on a ventilator a great deal of time. She's been on a feeding tube for 5 or 6 years at this point, and not only a feeding tube, but her third type of feeding tube, because even that is reacted to. And it started out being a gastric tube, and then it went down lower in her digestive tract. And it's been a struggle for her even to get the kind of nourishment she needs to remain alive, not to mention the kind of treatment. And because she's been now intubated something like 80 times, there's been damage to her whole breathing mechanism, her trachea. And one by one, part of her body is self-destructing. She had to be on the feeding tube because her esophagus was so damaged that it no longer could function. It kept having holes in it, among other things. And at this point, she's also, finally, I can't imagine why it didn't happen earlier, the diagnosis. I know the psychological damage happened earlier, but she was finally diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome because of all these intubations and all the extremity that's gone on to try to keep her alive. They thought they had her anesthetized under certain circumstances for certain procedures, and it didn't work, among other things. So at this point, and also I should mention that up until now, she's held the idea of dying at arm's length, which most of us do. How many of us really look forward to dying? Even people who are committing suicide aren't necessarily looking forward to dying. In a fairly high percentage of cases, people that can commit suicide, as it turns out, it's felt that it was attempted suicide as a threat that went wrong and actually completed. There's a whole personality disorder of people that are desperate to change their situation to the point where they threaten suicide or attempt suicide. I've known some of them. They have had horrendous histories. We can count ourselves fortunate, no matter what our own histories have been, that we have the good karma of being able to be here in this beautiful little zendo with such tremendous depth of peace and power, and that we can practice. Because I've known people who are so badly hurt that in this lifetime they won't ever be able to truly practice Zen. So let me start with an early email message from her. The first is a little bit desperate. It was from a week ago. She said, "I'm sick and my situation is dire. It's too hard to text so late. We'll sum it up. I got transferred against my will to UCSD. They want to do a high-risk surgery. I don't want to do it. If I do it, I die. Or if I don't do it, I die. I don't trust them. I don't know what to do. I'm on a ventilator." And then the next one was 5 days later. "Hi, so far I'm still in the ICU at UCSD. Today they want to do a bronchoscopy to see if I'm eligible for a different surgery that I'm willing to do. I also put in a request to transfer to another hospital. I'm on a ventilator, and if they pull the tube out, I will suffocate because my airway is too narrow. If they can't or won't dilate my trachea, then I'm opting to pull out the tube and die." And I'll share with you what I wrote back to her in response to that email. "Please let me know what the decision is. I'm with you, whatever you decide. There is a place beyond life and death, a place of such presence that no one is dying, as there is no death. Truly, life, with a capital L, is undying as it is unborn. The scroll over the altar at Mountain Gate reads, quote, out of not one thing arise the 10,000 things, close quote. It is most fascinating that quantum physics is learning this. I will be traveling today. That was the day I started out to head here. Please text me your decision and any details around it. So 2 days later, she responds, they did an emergency surgery to dilate my trachea enough for the tube to be removed without my throat collapsing, but it's only temporary. I decided that I will no longer get intubated. For me, that means death. It could be tomorrow, or next month, or next year. But my track record is over 80 intubations and anaphylaxis on a nearly weekly basis. I always said when my suffering became so profound that my quality of life became non-existent, then it was time to finally let the disease win. I'm still in ICU and not going well, but I'm hoping to eventually go home. There is a verse to one of the koans in the Momonkan that says, how will it be for you when the light of your eyes is falling? Will you be struggling like a crab with its seven arms and eight legs, struggling to get out of the boiling water? It's something worth considering, not in terms of setting yourself up for some stress and some fear, but for exploration. There's another metaphorical tale of a man being led up a mountain. It's pitch black dark when they start out. And there's on either side of his of him are monks, Buddhist monks, one holding each hand. And as they get higher and higher on this mountain, it begins to get lighter and lighter, and suddenly he realizes he's climbing on a mountain of skulls. And he exclaims about this, and one of the monks said, these are your own lives. A mountain of skulls. How many times have we been born and died? In one sense, we're born and die every moment. We go to bed, we don't know if we're going to wake up. We breathe out, we don't know if we're going to be able to breathe back in again. Things happen in our life. Painful things happen. And then they pass. Somebody says something hurtful to us, and it hurts. And in that moment, we die a little, and then we come back to life. What is this life and death? Manke talks about what he calls the unborn, which is what we really are. Unborn because who we really are was never born. And if it's never born, it can never die either. And yet, most of us have experienced death at this point in our life. A parent, a grandparent, some relative, maybe even a sibling or some friends. Several years ago, I was at a grade school, a middle school actually, in Southern California, giving a talk on Buddhism. And I asked this combination of three classes of kids in this auditorium, if anybody had known anybody who died. And several hands went up, quite a few hands went up, actually. And I asked them, you know, who was it that died? For one child, it was his grandparent. But for several kids, it was their friends. They died in car accidents. We don't know when it'll come, but what is it about it that is frightening? Or is it really frightening? Is the fear because we don't understand it, because we don't know what's going to happen? Fear of the unknown is pretty prevalent in the world. It's one of the things that creates prejudice, bias. But in the old days, in the Middle Ages, when they were able to build ships that could sail the oceans, they were afraid to sail outside of land. They were afraid they wouldn't be able to find their way back. It's a metaphor for the fear most people have of dying, the great unknown, a fear of disappearing. Who is it really that disappears? What is it that disappears? It's kind of interesting that quantum physics has begun to discover that there is no such thing as time as we understand it. The past, present, and future are not three different times. It can explain a lot of things that people who are particularly sensitive can perceive. But it also adds to the mystery of who we are and what will happen. More important than who we are and what will happen is how will we deal with it? How will we work with it? Will we be like that crab struggling to get out of the boiling water? Or will we have so much familiarity with not knowing and the adventure that that opens us to, the excitement, the potential? That it will be a most fascinating adventure for us. What I have said to this woman in the most recent email to her, which was yesterday. When we walk into the fear of dying and feel the full extent of the quality of the energy we call fear, something miraculous happens, and right in the middle of it, we are free of it. It can grow much more profoundly deep and free as we continue to allow ourselves to open to the exploration of the journey. It may take practice, but you can do it, and the result can be astonishing in a most positive way. This is your Zen practice at this time in your life. And I added, the next question is whether your family can accept that decision and not freak out around you. I assume you can qualify for hospice. Might there be residential palliative care or hospice you could qualify for? A more peaceful and understanding environment you can be in for the most important journey of your life, the easier it will be for you. And I signed it with much love. How will it be when the light of your eyes is falling, your own eyes? Will you be like the crab with his seven arms and legs struggling to get out of the water? Or will you have understood something more profoundly deep than that? Will you have worked with walking into fear, embracing it, allowing yourselves to feel fully its energy to the point where it dissolves and you dissolve as well? Those people who have had near-death experiences and come back to life have lost their fear of death. I know one of these people personally. I actually know two of these people personally. One of them was he's Italian, actually Swiss Italian, or Italian Swiss, whichever you want to call it. Born and raised in Switzerland, but of Italian heritage. And a musician, or he was a musician, quite a good musician. And at one point, an American rock band was doing a world tour, and I don't remember the name of the band, but they were quite famous. Many platinum records, many gold records, traveling all over the world, but rather violent karma, actually. Something like five of the band members had died violently. At any rate, they lost one of their band members, their bass guitarist, as they arrived in Switzerland, and they were interviewing potential replacements. And he was 19 years old at the time, and he got the job. Traveled around. By the time this incident happened, he was married and had a one-year-old child, and they'd been traveling, touring for quite some time. They were at a publicity party in London at the time. He walked out at 5 o'clock in the morning to go home and woke up 6 weeks later in the hospital, completely, totally blind. He couldn't even see light and dark. Totally paralyzed, mute. The only thing he could do was hear. Doctors later told him that he had been clinically dead 6 to 8 minutes. As it turns out, he'd been stabbed in the heart. Somebody had wanted his money or something. He didn't know what they wanted, and he didn't. It was not an issue for him anymore. There was no regret, no anger, no remorse, no feeling of needing to have retribution, nothing. It was done. It was gone. It was finished as far as he was concerned. I met him 16 years after that happened. No, 15 years, because by then his son was 16 years old. His wife promptly left him, and he worked with his mind to recover. He focused first on getting one of his toes to move. After 3 months, he was successful. After, 7 months, I think it was, he began to see light and dark. And by the end of the year, he could see again. And gradually he recovered. Mostly, when I met him, he had some symptoms of what's known as Parkinsonism. It's not Parkinson's, but it manifests, it looks like Parkinson's. And he had what's called a drop attack at one point. I met him in Japan. I happened to be the guest house keeper at Soginji. At the time, he and his girlfriend and the male friend of his who was there to help him out if he needed help were traveling to India, because he had completely switched roles and gone into spiritual practice in India. And he had somehow met Hariroshi in Italy when Hariroshi was there, and they became good friends. he described what had happened from his perspective. He found himself, he said, first in a deep grave and found himself wondering how he was going to get out of this. And the next thing that happened was suddenly there was a child in the grave with him. And he's thinking, oh gosh, now how am I going to get this kid out too? And then this woman's face came through the wall of the grave and said, don't worry, it's going to be okay. And then disappeared, and the child disappeared as well. And then he found himself outside the grave. And in the distance, there was a group of animals, all with different kinds of horns on their heads. And he found himself fascinated by this, and suddenly found himself in the midst of them with a horn growing out of his own head. He called this the Bardo of Curiosity. And the next thing that happened was that he found himself in a field of beautiful flowers, so profoundly peaceful. All he wanted to do was stay there. And then he found himself waking up in the hospital. He has no fear of death, none whatsoever. And actually has become a spiritual teacher in Europe. He is the only person I have ever met that doesn't put out a vibe. And I know this because he asked me if I would go for a walk with him. The backstory on this is that when I went to live in Japan, I had just barely recovered from encephalitis and meningitis and had the results of a secondary infection that took out my seventh facial nerve 100%, so half my face was paralyzed. And it was beginning to come back. By this time, it was about 9 or 10 months later. And he took me for a walk, and I said, well, I can show you where, you know, I can tell you where you can walk. I imagine you'd want to go for a walk with your girlfriend. He said, no, I want to walk with you. So he and I went out in the neighborhood and climbed up to Shinto Shrine that was nearby. And partway up the stairway, which was a long stairway, he said, stop. And he turned around and he faced me. And he started putting his hands out about a foot away from me and going down my body, about a foot away from it. And there was something happening, something barely perceptible happening, to the point where I closed my eyes because it was something I did not want to interfere with. And the remarkable thing about closing my eyes was that there was nobody standing out there. There was absolutely no vibe. A short while later, he said, there, I've untied a knot in your solar plexus. And your face should be getting better within 3 hours. And it did. I asked him at one point if it would ever go back to normal, and he hesitated, and then he said, yes. So it's a bit lopsided, but essentially normal. I'm telling you these things because there's a reality that is beyond what we assume is reality. And we can open to that true reality. And when we do, it frees us. Incredibly so, immeasurably. It frees us to the point where it does not matter, as I said in the opening talk, what circumstances we might find ourselves in, such as this young woman who's still in the ICU in Southern California, weighing whether to just let go and die or to keep fighting. The fact that we're sitting here in this Zendo says that at some level we're yearning to open to that reality, the only true reality there is. And we now have the tools with which to do it. Extending the out-breath as far as we can with full presence of the experience of it in the body, not the ideas of it, not trying to trace it from some part of our body to some other part of our body, but with the sensations of breathing out, 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 out. Because what that does is it requires focus, increasingly intent focus, which also requires letting go of anything else we would be thinking of, feeling, wanting. And that is a doorway to liberation. If we are willing to walk steadily into it, and fear will come up, but taste the fear. What is fear really? Extending the out-breath with an openness to possibility that there's something truly freeing that you can open to that will be life transforming in a most positive way. This is our practice. That's the fundamental practice beneath all the koan work. So, let's go about it. And thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.